Okay, yeah, I gather everybody can hear me. Okay, so do I just click to get this going? Okay, great. So titled my talk is Substance Use Among Diverse LGBT Populations, a Qualitative Investigation. I want to thank my co-author, Karen Phelan, who couldn't be here today. And our funding sources, of course, this was funded by a postdoctoral grant from NIMH, as well as the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Institute at University of Washington, where I'm located, and the Society for Psychological Study of Social Issues. No relationships to disclose. Okay, so just a brief summary of some of the background literature on this topic. What we know from several studies is that LGBT populations seem to be at elevated risk for substance use and abuse. With alcohol, this appears to be most consistently found among women, but with other types of drug use and abuse, differences, sexual orientation differences exist for both men and women. So the next question is, why is this? And this is an area that we have relatively less data about. So one hypothesis is the minority stress hypothesis. In other words, living in a society where your life is not the norm creates increased levels of stress, which can lead you to abuse alcohol and drugs. However, there are a few studies that actually examine this. There's some indication that harassment and discrimination might be associated with alcohol and other drug use, and also that the stress associated with first coming out might be associated with drinking. There's some other research looking at peer pressure and social norms as factors, gay bars as the primary venue in which to socialize with other LGBT people, as well as a history of victimization, which we know in the general population correlates with alcohol and drug use. But the purpose of the current study was to extend the current body of literature by using qualitative methodology to look at the unique factors that contribute to alcohol and drug problems among LGBT people. So in other words, what's different for this population? So these data were collected as part of the Rainbow Project, which is a larger qualitative investigation of 119 diverse LGBT adults in Washington state, both in urban and rural parts of the state. And just briefly, here's the demographics of our participants, mean age, late 30s, fairly evenly distributed among men and women, and we had quite a big representation of bisexual and queer and other not lesbian and gay identified folks. Pretty racially diverse for an LGBT study, only 53% were white. Geographically, only 60% were in Seattle, which is, of course, the largest and most gay-friendly city in the state of Washington. And so people were spread out across the state, fairly high levels of education, but relatively low levels of income compared to that education. We advertised widely, and I won't go into all the sampling, but I'd be happy to talk about that later if you'd like. We did focus groups and key informant interviews to collect our data. We offered participants of color matching with the interviewer, and we also had some specific groups where we recruited people across various vantage points for alcohol and drug use. So people in recovery, people who currently heavily abuse alcohol and drugs, people who are lifelong abstainers, and I forgot to put on the slide, we also had a group of treatment providers. So our analyses, briefly, we transcribed all of our interviews and focus groups, and then we coded in Atlas TI software, and we resolved our code discrepancies through consensus. And our framework for analysis was a grounded theory framework. So in other words, we didn't go in with any preconceived type of theory. What we did is just really read through and listened to the words of participants to identify repeating ideas and then develop these into themes and link those together in constructs. So now I'll go into our results. So similar to other studies about alcohol and other drug use, there are a lot of generic reasons for using substance use. So things like childhood abuse, a dysfunctional family of origin, family history of alcohol and drug problems, and other comorbid mental health problems were all linked by these participants to their substance use. However, what we're focusing on here is the LGBT-specific factors. And when we looked at these themes, and I'll go into what the themes actually were, they ended up sort of falling out into two interrelated categories. The first one is factors associated with broader society influences on LGBT people, and the second is factors within the LGBT community. Okay, so this is the diagram representing the first set of themes that we came up with. And so if you look at broader society, within that, LGBT people hold a minority status. And so along with that comes heterosexism, which is prejudice and discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity, but also isolation. So even if we had a society where there was no discrimination and it was perfectly okay to be LGBT, you're still somewhat isolated. You typically grow up in a family where you're different from other family members, and so that's different from other types of minority groups. And also, it's just there are smaller numbers of LGBT people, so it's harder to find other people like yourself. And along with those two things comes cumulative trauma, which I'm sort of conceptualizing that as just a number of bad things happening to a person or being at risk for a number of bad things over the lifespan. So all of those lead to minority stress, which is the stress associated with being LGBT. And so the blue words within that are the core themes that came out of our participants' words. And so those are denying or suppressing being LGBT, numbing out or self-medicating painful feelings, reducing inhibition to sort of act upon one's identity or feelings, a feeling of shame that leads to alcohol and drug use, seeking a safe place to be LGBT, given that it's not often safe to just express yourself out in general society, and then a really strong need to connect with other LGBT people. So I'll give some quotes directly from participants that illustrate these themes. So this is a general quote about minority stress. I just think it's not an easy road being gay. I mean, we constantly have to either hear something about ourselves or in some ways are forced to defend who we are. I think I felt bombarded constantly. Here's an example of numbing out and self-medicating. There's a deep hurt and deep feeling of not being able to satisfy to be loved just for who you are. And that hurt and pain, the only way to make it go away is to drink or do something to numb it. An example of denying and suppressing. Alcohol and drugs are just an escape from everything as far as being gay, lesbian, whatever. You indulge yourself in that to kind of forget who you are. Here's an example of reducing inhibition for exploring one's gender. I think a lot of it, too, allowed me to drop some of my inhibitions or my fears because at 21 or 22 years old, I would sit down with the guys at the bar and drink beer and all this other stuff after we got done logging all day. This is one of our rural participants. And then I would go home and climb into the bathtub and shave my legs, get out and get all dressed up in a skirt and nylons and all this kind of stuff. Well, when you're still about a half toddy, you have the tendency to venture out the door a little further. This is a transgender person living in Central Washington. And here's an example of seeking a safe place to be LGBT. So again, thinking about that, you know, you can't just walk into any establishment or walk down the street and be safe. That's your safe haven, you know. That's if you want to be able to live like normal people and go out with your friends and be okay. Then gay bars were like a really good place. Here's a quote that illustrates sort of the overall idea about isolation. We don't have the luxury of, like, it's hard, like the things that our family would rally around us for, or just the community in general, there's things that we have to go through by ourselves, or we're expected to go through by ourselves where the straight community wouldn't. So really a sense of being different and being isolated. And isolation can lead, again, to a need to numb out and self-medicate. Here's a transgender person again. My stressor was always isolation, because you can imagine a young kid in a little town in Kansas who looks like a little boy and wants to be a little girl just sticks out. There was nobody in my family I could talk to. When I got in my teen years and I found alcohol, I found for the first time that it numbed the feelings of being so isolated. And isolation also leads to a strong need to connect with other LGBT people, which can lead directly to things related to alcohol and drugs. If I'm looking for somebody in a social way, the biggest ways are either doing drugs or alcohol, or in 12-step groups, which are, you know, people who are no longer doing drugs or alcohol. Like, nobody invited me to different parties because I don't use drugs, or I don't drink like heavy drinks, cocktails, and fancy things. They never invited me. And when you start doing all those things, okay, you're welcome. So that's also a sense of peer pressure. And cumulative trauma, as I mentioned, sort of a number of things adding up over the lifespan, can again lead to numbing out and self-medicating. Those are the major influences: the rejection by the parents, child abuse, peer isolation and abuse, the feeling of not being as worthy as other people because you happen to be homosexual or some permutation thereof, And then, of course, you start to engage in more and more self-destructive behavior and all of those things you blame yourself for, and you can just keep multiplying. And here's an example of how discrimination or heterosexism can lead to a need to numb out or self-medicate. I was in a fraternity in college the first time, and that was rough. It was right at the beginning of the AIDS epidemic. It was literally a witch hunt on campus, and a lot of people were naming names of who was gay. I was in the hospital with heart palpitations, and that's when I really started drinking a lot. Okay, so this next circle, we just talked about some of the influences that are related to broader society. This circle represents influences within the LGBT community that can lead to substance use. And you can see that the four arrows leading in are broader society influences on the LGBT community. So we can't look at the LGBT community out of context. So within the community, some themes that came up were linked to things like targeted marketing by the alcohol industry, bars as socialization venues, oppression within the LGBT community, and a sense that as a community, we haven't really gotten beyond adolescent development. And so the core themes that came out of that from the participants' words are socializing in alcohol and drug settings, linking identity to alcohol and drug use, and crossing normative boundaries. And here's some examples of these themes. Gay Pride is paid for by Budweiser, and they pass out all these free Mardi Gras beads with free Budweiser signs on them and buttons with rainbows. And that's kind of weird, because you pick the LGBT community because we're oppressed and because we have all these problems to deal with. Bars are like the number one place that I would think of to go socialize, to meet somebody. Where I would go for community in the past has always been the bars, and so I end up drinking a lot more. This is an example of the adolescent development. The thing I've been seeing is that for our community, we come out later, and so it's like our period of adolescence happens when we're in our 20s, 30s, you know, 50s, 60s, whenever somebody decides to come out, and since that's linked so much with substance use. And for younger people, as I said, who get into drugs early, they denied themselves their early adult development. And as a community, it shows. As a community, we suffer from arrested emotional development. Somewhere along the line, we never got beyond adolescence as a community. There's also a sense of linking one's identity to substance use. In other words, being LGBT means you drink a lot and do drugs. I think that's the perception. Absolutely. You're supposed to party. Being gay is supposed to be about having sex and having fun and doing drugs. When I was a teenager, that's where you went, gay bars. And that's what being gay was about, sort of, until I figured out myself. I thought all gay people partied like that. I thought if you were gay, that means you drink it up and do all kinds of drugs. And with some people I wanted to date or sleep with or whatever, I felt I kind of had to keep up with them to do what they were doing. Here's an example of how oppression within the community can further perpetuate such stereotypes. This is an African-American man who says, "Dealing with white gay males, every time I meet a white guy, he always wants to put drugs under my nose, the white powder. I don't do drugs. The reality of the guys I've met since I've been in this city, they want to put all that white powder under my nose because all blacks do drugs. That's what I get, and I hate that, and it's stressful to me." And finally, the last quote, and this didn't come through as strongly, and we actually have some debate within our team about the relevance of this theme, but I thought I would present it, is this sense of crossing normative boundaries. So the idea that you're already sort of going outside of what society has prescribed for you by being LGBT, and so why not experiment with other sorts of behaviors as well? So this person said, "I think that also a gift of being queer is, for me, there's a freedom in that, given for a lot of years in some states, my basic sex act was illegal, then why should I really care about some other standards or rules?" How am I doing on time? Okay. So I have a few more quotes associated with coming out. And so I didn't have a good way of diagramming this, but I guess what I want to say about coming out is that it occurs in the context of these LGBT community factors as well as the broader society factors, but it really emerged as a specific developmental phase, no matter what age a person comes out at, that really deserves attention when looking at substance use. And so we found a unique theme of experiencing confusion, but that this idea of coming out linked to some of the other themes as well. In terms of experiencing confusion, here's a good quote illustrating this. I went away to college, and I was suddenly in a huge girls' dorm, surrounded by all these girls, and I couldn't make sense of my feelings. Totally confused, and I drank, a huge contributor to taking my first drink. And here's denying and suppressing in the context of coming out. I actually used to drink when I was dealing with coming out. I used to drink, sleep with my girlfriend, get up the next day. Shit, I was a drunk. I didn't mean to do that. I'm not a lesbian. I just drank a little too much. I definitely consciously used it to avoid dealing with coming out. I made an excuse so I didn't have to deal with, what are you doing? Who are you? What do you want to do? Who do you love? And I did drink a lot at that point. When you're coming out, you're also really seeking a way to connect with other LGBT people. I came out in 1977. I would say that in that time, with rare exception, the bar scene was how gay men came out and the only place to go to socialize. Okay, so just a brief discussion before I end. I think a unique contribution here is that we looked at LGBT-specific issues in a sample of LGBT people that were really diverse in terms of sexual identity, gender identity, age, race, ethnicity, and also in various geographic locations within the same state. We also are unique in that we recruited participants across various vantage points with respect to their substance use. And so when we're looking for sort of a framework to put all of these different themes into, we sort of linked this back to some of Nancy Krieger's work on eco-social theory and various other ecological theories of individual development. And, you know, I think what our study really highlights is that we can't look at LGBT substance abuse just at the individual level. We really need to look at social and community factors, both broader society as well as things within the LGBT community. And so a question that this raised is, so is the sort of the broader society minority stress pathway and then the LGBT community and the norms within that community, are those two separate pathways to alcohol and drug use? And so really future research is needed on this. And actually another colleague and I just submitted a grant application to look at this very thing based on these qualitative data. There's a lot of literature in the general alcohol and drug world about looking at coping motives, people who, you know, drink or use substances to cope. And there are also some models of norms-based models. So, you know, this is what I think my peers are doing, so I'm going to do this. But these things haven't really been applied in a systematic way to LGBT populations, and that's what we're hoping to do. I think two important things that emerge is that coming out needs to really be targeted in prevention efforts because it's a very specific developmental phase linked to substance use. And in fact, as people are coming out at earlier ages, they may be even more vulnerable to lifelong problems. There's also the need to connect with other LGBT people, and I wish I had time to present some of the other really moving quotes that we found. But this is something I think that can be really harnessed in treatment and recovery efforts. In terms of future research, I mentioned our grant proposal to look at these different pathways to substance use. I think that it would be important also to look at how does diversity matter. I think there are certainly going to be gender differences and probably other differences important to look at. And then some clinical trials. We have very little outcomes data on anything related to LGBT people going through substance use. I know that some of my colleagues here will be presenting things along these lines. But I think, you know, testing, for example, how does provider training make a difference? If you give some of this information to providers, do they get different outcomes? What is the outcome of having an LGBT-specific program? In terms of public health practice, I think that, you know, again, we need to target things at multiple levels, so obviously changing discriminatory laws, policies, practices in broader society. But I think that, you know, there's a lot of change that can occur within the LGBT community. And I know, you know, again, I'm sure there are lots of people who are working on this in various communities. So we really need interventions that are going to change our beliefs within the community about what's normative and a need for venues for socializing that don't focus on substances. On an individual level, I think that, you know, modifying existing programs and creating new programs that really recreate this safe space for LGBT people, and of course, provider training on how to deal with these specific issues and maintain safe milieus. And, you know, I didn't have time to present the results about recovery, but there were a lot of individuals that talked about harassment and discrimination from other clients when they went to seek treatment. So I think that's an important thing to be addressed by providers. And that is the end of my talk.
Thank you, Kimberly. Are there any questions for her? Okay. The next presentation is cigarette smoking among gay, lesbian, and bisexual residents of the Inland Empire in California. The authors are Aaron Gardner, Wendy Betancourt, Dante Mokas, and Kevin McConis, and it will be presented by Aaron Gardner.
Next presentation.
Yeah, next presentation. Got it.